It's not just a game, it's not just a grass. Lawn Solutions Australia is the exclusive home of Australia's best sports turf varieties. For the world's best grasses like Tiff Tough Hybrid Bermuda and Sir Grange Zoysia, contact Lawn Solutions Australia at lawnsolutionsaustralia.com.au. Hello and welcome to episode 105 of The Thing About Golf, the podcast series from Golf Australia magazine exploring the multitude of reasons that people fall so hard for this game. It'd be fair to say that since the 1970s, most golf fans' interaction with the game has come via television. And while we like to complain about them, those who commentate on the game in that medium play a pivotal role in our most memorable moments. Who could forget, for example, Vern Lundquist's "Oh My In Your Life" call at the 2005 Masters? But perhaps the most recognisable utterance in the game came from our guest on episode 105. It was the 2001 Players Championship when Tiger Woods holed a monster putt on the famous 17th green, prompting Gary Koch to utter those immortal words, "That's better than most." My colleague John Huggan is not surprisingly a friend of Koch's, and he joins me now for a quick introduction to what is a terrific chat. Huggy, welcome. How do you know Gary Koch?
Well, I can't pretend that Gary and I are close pals or anything, but I've bumped into him. My time at Golf Digest in America, I was there for 8 years between 88 and 96. And that generation, of which Gary's a member, of which I am too, really, I'm very familiar with those guys far more than the younger guys, simply through the fact that the job I had at Digest at the time, I was in charge of the instruction stuff, and I was out on tour more than anybody else on the staff. So plus, I stood out a little bit because of my accent at the time, and yes. So everybody kind of knew who I was. And Gary would be one of those, I suppose. But he's always been, he was a good player. I mean, people forget, you mentioned his TV work there, but yep. You forget what a good player Gary Koch was. I mean, he's a multiple PGA Tour winner and played in the Walker Cup, which is where I actually spoke to him. I was at St. Andrews. He just attended on his own dime this year's Walker Cup as a member of the 75 Walker Cup, and they had all the former players sitting around in a big circle at the opening ceremony on the first tee at St. Andrews, and there he was with all the rest of them. So never forget what a good player Gary Koch was, apart from the familiarity of his voice on television.
Well, it's true of so many TV commentators, isn't it, Huggy? We forget. I think there's probably a generation of people who don't know or would be pressed to know that Ian Baker Finch won the Open. And Richie Benaud, similarly. I grew up not realising Richie Benaud was a great cricketer in his day. I only knew him from his television work, which is a bit of a shame. As you say, a really good player, clearly, in his day. But the fact that he's lobbed up to the Walker Cup at St. Andrews, it tells you he's kind of a proper golfer and a real golf fan too, Huggy.
Yeah. I mean, again, that generation, they're far more... Well, it's a generalization and maybe a stereotype in here a little bit, but they seem to have more feeling for the game than the younger lads do. The money was good, obviously, but it wasn't quite as outrageous as it is now. Plus Gary was a member. I did a piece, as I said, on the 75 Walker Cup team, American team, which I was making the case that that was the best American team of all time, so far at least. I mean, I think there was half a dozen of them, six or seven of them won nearly 60 PGA Tour events. Wow. By the time they were done. And a few multiple major champions, they had Curtis Strange in there, a few others. My mind's blanking there. But
if someone had written a story, Huggy, you could pull it out.
I know. Well, people can read it. People can go and look it up.
Good. I hope they do.
they can find out who I'm talking about. That's the people I can't remember.
That's your homework if you're a listener to the show. What stands out about Koch? On his television work, he's somewhat unique, isn't he? He doesn't stand out. There's nothing dramatic about him, but he's always kind of on the money. I know that you're one who likes to be critical of the TV commentators. I imagine he's one that probably gets a bit of a nod from you.
Yes, I think that they talk golf because they know golf, these guys. I mean, and it's a difficult thing broadcasting. I mean, I do cut them a bit of slack in that it's not journalism. It's a different thing. And they don't get the time, especially in American television, to actually show the breadth of their knowledge. I mean, Gary Koch would be a perfect example of somebody who would have shone far more had he been on the BBC. and had the time that the BBC always gave Peter Alice. And Dave Marr was a classic example of somebody, an American, who with a great depth of knowledge of the game, and had shone on the BBC because of that, because he had the time to tell us what he knew.
Yeah.
American television, I'm not sure you get that, you know.
No, well, you're on to the next ad break, aren't you? The next shot or the next.
Yeah, exactly.
Got to keep the pictures moving over. Huggy, we'll get to the interview now, but I'm going to give you an opening here, and I hope that you're going to take it. How does this interview compare to most of the other ones that you've done?
Oh, well above average. Yeah.
The line, Huggy, was better than most. What is wrong with you? Well, you're not on your game today, are you?
Do you know what time of day you've got me out of my bed to do this interview?
My apologies, Huggy. It's been fabulous to chat. I will let you get back to that. I know you've had some rain and other issues over there, so I hope that's all going okay. Great to chat to you today. Thanks for the intro. Well, let's get on and listen to Gary Koch.
My pleasure.
Okay, welcome to the latest edition of the Thing About Golf podcast. I'm joined this time around by a famous name, famous face, and certainly a famous voice. Gary Koch, what was and is the thing about golf for you?
Well, John, I was an only child. And once I was introduced to golf at a young age, I guess it was probably around 8 or 9 years old when I first went to a clinic for juniors. And I love the fact that I could do it on my own.
Yeah.
I could be out there for hours by myself, practicing, playing, whatever I wanted to do. And there was just an appeal to that, that I didn't have to rely on others. And once I started down that path, I was probably, I guess, 12, maybe 13 years old, where I pretty much decided. I had played some little league baseball and messed around with tennis and some other sports. But I decided at about that age, about around 13, that this is what I wanted to do. And from that time on, I mean, in the summers at home in Florida, I'd be dropped off at the golf course at 7:30 in the morning. I'd be picked up at 6 o'clock at night. Yeah. If some of my buddies were there and we played, great. If not, I could fill the time all by myself.
Your parents must have loved that, because they always want to know where the kids are at that age, and they would always know where
you were. No question. Yeah. And, you know, you look back on it now, and there were all kinds of rules and regulations that you had to follow if you wanted to be able to use the facility. And there were always adults around. So you were always kind of under somebody's eye, kind of watching what you were doing. And I think it certainly helped as far as the discipline necessary to kind of take, you know, junior golf on to the next stage of amateur and college golf and then on to professional golf.
Yeah. How soon was it clear that you were exceptional? I mean, you won the U.S. Junior Amateur.
Yeah, I won my age group in the Florida State Juniors at 14. That was the 12 to 14 age group, so kind of the younger age group. And I had played when I was 12 and 13.
Yeah.
But I won then, and then I won when I was 15, 16, and 17. I shot 68 in a junior tournament when I was 13.
Wow.
22 putts for 18 holes.
Yes. I was going to get to your putting. Yes.
Well, I was always a slight, you know, never heavy, never kind of skinny, scrawny looking kid. And I couldn't hit the ball that far. So I had to have a good short game and be a good putter if I was going to try to compete against the kids that were bigger than I was. The other thing was, when I first got going at the municipal course in Sarasota, Florida, Bobby Jones Municipal, which is still there.
Right.
It cost money to hit balls, but they had a little pitching green area and they had a huge putting green.
Right.
And of course it didn't cost any money to use those.
Yeah, yeah.
So I spent a lot of hours using that pitching green and that putting green.
Yeah. I can see how you did well when you made it to the Walker Cup. We're here at St. Andrews, just so that people know. That would have been meat and drink for you.
Well, it was. It was an interesting experience, John, no question. I had never been to Scotland, never played golf in Scotland. And by that time, let's see, 75, I was 22 years old and just out of college. In fact, I'd just gotten married. And coming here to the old course was technically our honeymoon.
Yeah.
So my wife and I are back this week.
She knew what she was getting into.
Yeah, well, she did. Yes, she didn't know what she was getting into. But our captain of the 75 team, Ed Updegraff, was around when the U.S. team lost here in 71.
Yeah.
And I think he kind of understood that part of the reason why the team, the U.S. team, lost in 71 was, A, they thought they were better than they were, and B, they didn't know the golf course.
Yeah, yeah.
So we got here very early. I mean, we were here probably, I think we traveled on Sunday, got here on Monday before the weekend of the matches.
Yeah.
And literally starting Tuesday, we played 36 holes a day, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, three straight days of 36 holes a day. Now, we had a pretty young team. I mean, most of us were college players, with the exception of Bill Campbell and Vinny Giles and Dick Sidorov. The rest of us were college players. And, you know, playing 36, and especially here, first time, I mean, it was exciting. But it really gave us a chance to learn the golf course and see it in different conditions. I had a wonderful local caddy, and he was very good about, you know, this wind direction, there's your target off this tee. You know, when the wind switches around, we need to go over here, and so forth and so on. And I think one of the reasons why we did so well is because we were well prepared. And I like the greens.
Well,
you know,
some people would argue you almost played too much. You know.
Yeah. Well. I don't think it would be borderline. Yeah, I don't think we felt that way.
Yeah.
You know, we none of us complained about playing that much golf in the run up to it. I found the greens fascinating because of the size, obviously, and I spent a tremendous amount of time practice putting from probably 40, 50, 60, 70 feet, which at home in the States, you never do.
No.
I mean, you just don't do that. I mean, I shouldn't say you don't ever do it. Occasionally you would do it. But here it seemed to me like there were so many places where I was going to end up on the green, where at home I would have missed the green and I would actually be chipping.
Yeah.
Now I was going to be putting. So I spent a lot of time in those practice rounds, a lot of 50, 60-foot lag putts, just trying to get a sense of the speed. The nice thing to me about a lot of the greens here, not a lot of break, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you can be 60 feet.
Well, they're slower.
Right, and they're slower. But, you know, you could be 60 feet away from the hole and there not be three different breaks to the putt, you know, a gentle left to right.
Some of them are really flat.
Yes, So, I spent a lot of time with that, and consequently during the matches, my lag putting was really good.
Yeah. Now, as you know, I spoke to you earlier this year on for a piece that it's just come out today, in fact.
I've gotten a couple of texts.
Yeah, to say that, now I was making the case that team is the best ever, at least for now. It might be overtaken in time, but would you agree, disagree with that?
I would certainly think that if we weren't the best up to this point, now again, you know, you've got to define the best, you know, is it the best amateur career?
We're talking here 57 PGA Tour wins and four majors.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, there was a lot of golf, really good golf played by that group after the Walker Cup.
Yeah.
No question.
Yeah.
Are we the best? Well, you know, I guess if you go by number of wins and majors and all that, we'd be the second best because Tiger's team would be the best because of Tiger.
He skews everything.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I think clearly when we were playing the matches here, I think the sense that the guys had was, you know, there haven't been many teams any better than our team at that point.
No.
Now, obviously, since then, there have been some pretty good teams.
There's a couple of possibilities.
Right.
11 and 17.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, they're a lot of good players.
Yeah.
But we'll see how they end up,
exactly.
you know, 20 years after the fact.
It's apples and oranges at the moment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah. We're talking Lynx golf. You mentioned this when we talked before, and I hadn't really appreciated it, I must admit, that twice you were the low American in the Open. You obviously had some kind of propensity for Lynx golf or a liking for
it.
I mean,
two things, John. Yeah. You know, my mother was born in London.
Yeah.
And I still have some relatives. In fact, when we leave here from the Walker Cup this weekend, we're going down to London. I have an uncle who's 94 years old.
Wow.
Was a career RAF, ended up being a group commander in the RAF. And I have some cousins and their families are still in the London area. So we'll go down and spend some. So I had a reason many times before the Open to come over early.
Right.
And see them.
Right.
So a lot of times I felt like I was way ahead of the curve because I was acclimated to the time and the weather.
Yeah. Yeah.
Before the Open ever started.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the guys would fly on Monday, get here Tuesday, try to play a practice round Tuesday afternoon, be ready to play by Thursday.
Yeah.
Well, I had already been there for a week.
Right. You know? Did you play any social golf?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. I did. Yeah. Played some. The other is I love the fact that it was different than the style of golf that's played in the United States. Probably a tendency of mine at home was to be a little too analytical, and certainly be a little too self-critical. When I got over here, it kind of freed me up and to not worry about my swing or anything else. It allowed me to visualize more what I wanted to see, what I wanted to have happen. And you know, you've played over here your whole life. I mean, when the conditions are bad, you can't be thinking about, you know, what my backswing, you know, where the club is. I mean, you're just trying to get that thing, get it low and get it straight or somehow. And I just, I really enjoyed that aspect of playing links golf.
I used that quote from you basically saying that same thing in the story. And I think that's the best quote in the story because it sums up links golf in about two sentences, which is... The last thing you want to worry about is where your right elbow is at the top of your backswing.
And it's funny how different players, you know, I think Tom Watson, obviously one of the reasons why he had so much success over here, because it freed him up to just play golf and not think about your swing or anything else. Some guys can't do that, you know, and I think that's why some guys come over here and really struggle. I mean, you know, one of my dear friends who was on that Walker Cup team in 1975, Curtis Strange. Curtis never really had any success over here. And you would have thought, you know, the type of player that Curtis was that allowed him to win two U.S. Opens, a real grinder. I mean, just, you know, never give up and all that.
Yeah.
You would have thought that kind of mentality would have worked very well over here.
Now, before we go any further, just in case Curtis listens to this, he did get round St. Andrews in 62 in the Dunhill Cup.
I understand.
We better get that in just in case.
No, I
know him well as you do.
And, I know.
You know, he'll want to hear that.
I understand.
Yeah. But did you ever feel that you had a chance? Were you close to winning?
Not really. The first one was at Turnberry in 86 when Greg Norman won. And the conditions were brutal. Brutal. And he shot 63 one round and got, you know, just got way out in front. I was very proud of the fact I was the only player in the field who did not make a double bogey that week.
Given the weather, that's
right. So I just, you know, I kind of plotted my way around and I think my high score was 73 and my low score was like 71. You know, I shot like 286. Yeah. I mean, I shot like six over par, which, you know, I finished sixth, I think it was somewhere. The other one was at Lytham St. Anne's, and it was the year that we ended up finishing on Monday.
Yeah, with Savvy won.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, that one, I got to the back nine, and I think I was within maybe two or three, you know, of the lead. And obviously you figure, hey, you know, if things go really, really well and, you know, maybe the guys behind, I think, you know, Nick Price was up there and Seve and I think maybe
Faldo.
Yeah, Faldo was up there as well. I think I ended up tying with, I think Couples and I tied for Lowell American that year, or maybe I beat him by shot. But anyway, there were three or four guys ahead of me that all had to do probably.
Yeah. Well, Seve played one of the great rounds.
They would have had to have some issues for me to, and then I would have had to play a really good back nine. I played a really good back nine, but nobody else, you know, had the issues that that I would have needed. So I wouldn't say I ever felt like I had a chance to win. No.
Now, in the midst of my, you know, in-depth research for this podcast, I notice you've got a degree in journalism.
I do.
So I feel as if I should ask you, what would you ask yourself at this point, Gavin?
That's a good question. I guess I would probably, if I were on the outside looking in, which did you enjoy more, your career playing golf or your career announcing?
Well, there you go. Yeah, that's a very good question.
And I'd have to say, even though I felt like I was successful on the PGA Tour. It's interesting now with all the media coverage and the amount that everybody's on television. I mean, I had six wins, and I had six wins in a generation where, you know, there were a lot of really good players.
Well, I was going to ask you how you felt. Is that par, right, under par, over par? What do you think, given your talent level?
You know, I guess coming out of college, I was probably in the top three amateurs coming out of college. I mean, I was runner-up in the NCAA 2 years in a row individually. Crenshaw beat me 1 year, and Curtis Strange beat me the other. So my expectations were probably initially higher than where I ended up. I had some injury issues fairly early in my career. I tore a ligament in my thumb. I had to have some surgery. I was out for almost a year. And back then, they didn't have the medical exemptions. And, you know, when you're out, when you came back, you had to figure out a way to get back in.
Did you have to go to tour school?
No, I didn't have to do that. I still kept my status of being able to Monday qualify.
Yes.
So it was quite different. But now, you know, I look at some of these guys with six wins and they're superstars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's all it takes.
You know, and it's just a different time. It's a different generation and so forth and so on. My television career, again, when I started, so my television career was probably the exact opposite of my playing career, expectation-wise, when I started.
Yeah.
Because I had no idea.
Yeah.
It was just a kind of a potluck. We were doing a University of Florida fundraising event for the golf team the Monday after Bay Hill in 1990. And I had not been playing well for probably a year plus on the tour. I had two daughters, young daughters that were at home with my wife, Donna, in Tampa. They were in school. I was on the road by myself. And yeah, you have friends, but you know, there's still a lot of alone time.
It's not the glamorous life.
No, it isn't. And, you know, another 72 or three, and I'm staring at a hotel room wall going,
you on, Mario,
I wonder if there's more to life than this. And Bob Murphy, who had played the tour and had gone to the University of Florida, had had arthritis issues with his hands. And he had started working for ESPN. ESPN had just started covering golf and was doing virtually all they covered was the then senior tour. Jim Colbert was working with them as well. And Jim was getting ready to turn 50 and had already told them, I'm going to go play on senior tour when I turn 50. So Murphy said to me, have you ever thought about doing television? And I looked right at him, and I can remember plain as day. I said, Bob, right about now, I'd try anything different. Because, you know, you know how golf is. I mean, especially when you're trying to play for a living and you're putting a lot of effort into it. And
you're
not,
beats you down, doesn't it?
Right. And it physically and mentally. And it seemed to be bringing out all the worst tendencies in my personality. And
give me some examples.
Well,
depression.
Just unhappy and frustrated. And as I mentioned earlier, I was probably always more critical of myself than I should have been.
Right.
And, you know, to go through a period of time like that, I just, you know, it just seemed like all the negatives were coming out rather than
it's a much underrated part of life.
Oh,
if you're not happy, I don't think you can play great golf.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, Bob said, well, if you're interested, I'll give the producer your number and he'll get in touch with you. Well, I kept playing and I didn't hear anything from this guy for 5 or 6 weeks. And then finally he called and he goes, look, between now and the end of the year, I've got five weeks where you could come out. We could use you. Colbert could help you a little bit. And then there's a couple others you'd do on your own as, you know, Jim's going to be gone. Are you interested? Well, I looked at the schedule and 1990, I was still an exempt player because I'd won in 88. So I still had an exemption.
You had a lot to give up there.
So I wasn't in all the invitationals necessarily, whatever, but I was still able to play pretty much whenever I wanted.
Yeah.
And I looked at the schedule and sure enough, of the 5 weeks he was saying there was an opportunity, three of those 5 weeks I normally played and they were courses that I kind of liked.
Yeah.
And I had a long discussion with my wife. I talked with my agent, Vinnie Giles.
I'm going to get to him in a minute.
Yeah. And the longtime sports editor at the Tampa Tribune, Tom McEwen, who had always been a real confidant. And you know, I always went to him and asked him his thoughts on stuff. And both of them said, look, you know, it's not that unusual in the course of a lifetime to have two or three different careers.
Yeah.
And he goes, and both said, look, it's not like you're getting totally out of golf. You know, you'll still be involved. So I said, you know what, if I'm going to give this, because back then, literally, there was no Golf Channel.
No.
So ESPN had three guys working, ABC and NBC and CBS. So there were about 12 spots for golf announcers.
Yeah.
That was it. And I said, you know, if I'm ever going to make a change, I've got to give this a try.
What did your wife say?
She was on board. Yeah, she was on board. And so I went out. I did those five events. And
was it on the course at this point?
I was on the course. Yeah, I was on, you know, microphone, headset out on the course, following around. And what I found immediately, I really enjoyed it. And I, from the standpoint that, ironically, I'd played a sport my whole life that was an individual sport. Now, yes, college golf and high school golf, you're part of a team. But, and as I mentioned earlier, you know, you're out on tour, and yes, you have good friends. But every Thursday morning when you tee off, there's one goal, and that's to beat everybody else.
Yeah.
Well, to me, I rapidly learned that television is probably the ultimate team effort. Now, you hit the clicker and the golf appears and, you know, you used to listen to myself and Johnny Miller and Roger Maltby and, you know, Dottie Pepper and Bob Murphy. But there's probably at a regular PGA Tour event 120 other people that are working behind the scenes. Yeah. And at a major or the Ryder Cup, there's probably 200 people working.
It's a bit of pressure there.
And they all have to do their job well for it to work. And I can remember early in my – you know, early on at ESPN, you know, I'd have a day where I'd come back to the trailer and think, God, you know, I had a great day today. You know, I really added some things to the show. I kind of set some things up before the guy hit the shot and, you know, it turned out just right and all that. And I'm real, you know, kind of proud of myself. Get back to the TV compound. And everybody's faces are long and, boy, what a terrible show. We had technical difficulties. We had this. You know, we didn't get all the ads in. Da, da, da. You know, I go, oh, yeah, it was a novel day. And then, you know, 2 days later, I'd come in thinking, I didn't add anything to the show today. You know, I just didn't – the circumstances didn't work out. I didn't have the time or whatever. And everybody at the compound's in a great mood. Oh, man, what a good show we had today. You know, some excitement here. And I'm going, yeah.
So it wasn't just about you.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, you feel like you're part of a team. And I just really grew to enjoy that aspect of it. I was very fortunate, you know, early on, because there's no way to practice this. I mean, you know, they kind of throw you out there and you either sink or swim. The producer at ESPN was a gentleman by the name of Andy Young, and the director was Steve Byme. Steve's still in the business. Andy has since retired. But they took an interest in me, obviously saw potential, and decided that they were going to help me get better.
Well, you've got a good voice for it. You know, that's almost a prerequisite, I would imagine. You know.
And so, sure enough, after I did those five events in 1990, they came back to me in 1991 and offered me a contract to work full-time for them.
Again, that's a big decision.
It was, but there were some positives there. I mean, all of a sudden, from the time I left my front door until the time I got home, somebody else was paying all my expenses instead of me. I could also create a schedule.
Yeah.
So I knew when I was going to be home, and I knew when I was going to be on the road. When you're playing and, you know, you're out and your intent is, you know, to play 2 weeks, and then all of a sudden you miss the cut both weeks – now I need to play more, you know, so boom, you start adding a couple of tournaments. So there was always that uncertainty, you know, when I was going to be home and when I was going to be gone. But with television, I knew for sure. So all of a sudden you could start planning things with your family and so forth and so on. Made a big deal.
It's a quality of life thing, isn't it?
It was. Yeah. And you know, I mean, perfectly honest, when we first started, the pay wasn't great, but it was nice, but it wasn't great.
Yeah, yeah.
But the opportunity, and I just looked at it as, look, this is the opportunity, and if I want to pursue this, I have to take advantage of this opportunity.
I'm going to circle back to broadcasting in a bit, but I don't want to sort of wave goodbye to your playing career before we go on. The obvious question is, what were the highlights? Which there were a few.
Yeah, well, there certainly were. I mean, you know, if you go all the way back, you know, I won the Florida Open when I was 16 years old. Well, to be honest with you, I won't say it was a fluke. I mean, I was a good player. I mean, I like I say, I'd won the Florida Junior and, you know, played well in the Florida Amateur by that age. But it was, you know, it wasn't a goal. It was just, I just went down there that week and played, and I happened to play better than everybody else.
Yeah.
The next year, I won the USGA Junior. That was a big deal. I had played in 68 at the country club. I was the medalist, but I got beat early in match play. Yeah. I went out to Seattle or to Spokane the next year for the junior. I made match play. I got through, I don't know, a couple of matches. So my high school teammate had won in 68, Eddie Pierce, and then had a chance to become the first guy to win 2 years in a row the next year and got beat in the finals by a guy by the name of Ali Trompas, who was from Southern California. Right. Well, sure enough, he came back in 1970 and had a chance to be the guy to win two in a row. Well, I met him in the semifinals, so there was real motivation there, and I was able to beat him, and then I went on to win the next day. So to me, there was a real goal there and an expectation that, hey, if I wasn't the best, I was certainly one of the best, and this was my last opportunity to win that. So that was a big deal.
Tiff Tough Hybrid Bermuda means less work and more play. Tough by name and by nature, this turf variety, supplied exclusively by Lawn Solutions Australia, is the perfect choice for your home lawn. With superior drought tolerance, speedy recovery and toughness, Tiff Tough really is the smart grass. For more information and to find your nearest accredited supplier, head to lawnsolutionsaustralia.com.au.
You know, you first went on the PGA Tour. I mean, that's an accomplishment. I mean, I went through the tour school in the fall of 75. Went right out.
That Walker Cup team dominated that school, by the way.
Yeah, there are a lot of guys that did very well. Yeah. So I went right out in January. Monday qualified at the very first tournament in Tucson. Got in. Back then, if you made the cut, you got to play the next week. So I made the cut of every event on the West Coast. So I was playing some nice golf. I wasn't playing great, but I was playing some nice golf. We had a little break. I think they had the players down at Fort Lauderdale or at Inverary or whatever. And, of course, I wasn't in that. But I was in it. The next week was Hattiesburg, the opposite the Masters. And then the next week was Tallahassee, which was opposite the Tournament of Champions out at La Costa. And, you know, I played four really good rounds in Tallahassee. I came from behind the last day. And
What year was that?
You know, that was 1976.
Right.
So I won in like my eighth start on the tour.
Yeah.
Made about a 6-foot putt on the last hole to beat John Mahaffey by a stroke. So that was, you know, that kind of gives you the sense that, you know what, you belong.
What were the Mondays like?
Mondays were the hardest thing in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, let's put it this way. And again, I would never knock the generation of players that play now. They're great players. Don't get me wrong. But I think our generation coming through that system were tougher mentally than the new generation.
Yeah.
So making the cut was huge. And to me, some of the most pressure I ever felt playing professional golf would be coming down on Friday afternoon. Yeah. If you're on the cut line, it's obvious you don't have your best game.
Yeah.
And knowing if you don't make the cut, you're getting in the car immediately and driving to the next tournament, not even the tournament course, but
2 days to kill
another course, trying to learn that to get ready for the Monday qualifying. So the first Monday qualifying that I went through in Tucson, the one that I made, my very first tour event as a pro, I'd played a couple as amateurs, get to Tucson, 100 and it's like 180 players trying to Monday qualify. Because back then, the PGA of America club professionals were automatically in the
How
Mondays.
How many spots?
Yeah. So they had two courses. So there was five spots at each course. So close to 100 players at each course, five spots. So frost delay, sitting in the car, heater on, you know, waiting to play. I was off like the second or third group. Go out, shoot 68. get my keys, caddy, go put my clubs in the car. Don and I go in the clubhouse, going to get a little lunch. I'm thinking, you know, this is not so bad, you know. this Monday qualifying, no big deal. About an hour later, my caddy comes running and, give me the keys. I said, what? He goes, playoff.
Yeah.
I said, what? He goes, yeah, we're in a playoff. Goes and gets a club, hits some balls. There are seven guys for two spots.
Right. Yeah.
I birdied the sixth extra hole to get the last spot to get in. And then made the cuts, you know, on all the events on the West Coast.
Do you subscribe to the notion that, you know, you touched on it a little bit there, that the modern generation, because of the all-exempt system and all the rest of it, that it's easier just to drift along?
Well,
you don't have to win anymore?
Yeah. Well, here's my take on it. I think it allows them to play the game very differently.
Right.
So we talk about it all the time about how aggressive they are. And how they shoot at every pin and all that. Well, that's easy to do when you know if you miss the cut that you're automatically going to play the next week if you want to, you know, if you're in the top 125. So I think I observe a couple of things from when I was doing TV, watching the young guys play. A, the aggressiveness, and B, the lack of stick-to-itiveness if things get going bad.
Yeah.
So if they were to get off to a bad start and say they're three or four over par after the first nine holes, it's like, okay, you know, not this week.
Yeah.
You know, we'll worry about it next week.
Yeah.
In our day, you know, if you got three or four over, you kept grinding. You kept trying as hard as you could because you knew how important it was to be hanging around on the weekend.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing that is so ironic now when you look at the money and look, the money, you know, I don't begrudge the young guys the money they're making now. They're the best in the world. They deserve it. The best in baseball and football and basketball. They all make that count.
Yeah.
No problem. But literally when we started, you could make the cut and not get paid.
Right. Oh, didn't know that. Yeah.
They paid 70 places and just 70 places.
Right.
So if 75 guys made the cut, and you happen to finish 72nd or 3rd or 4th or 5th or 1st, and they were you got zero.
Yeah, and you played another 2 days.
Yeah. You played all week.
Yeah.
You had a caddy fee. You had hotel bill. You had transportation, everything. You got zero.
Yeah.
Nothing. So it's come a long way. It's changed a lot. It's come a long way.
Yeah. You subscribe to the theory, which I've put out there a couple of times, that consistency – these days at that level is the most overrated attribute you can possibly have because everybody, and quite rightly, everybody's talked about how great Scottie Scheffler has been. His level has been incredible. But would you rather be that guy or the guy who hits five home runs a year and does nothing else?
You know? I think it depends a lot on the personality. You know, I think some guys are comfortable with having those highs and lows, you know, and I mean, I saw something, I don't know, this was a couple of years ago when I was looking through stats or something at the end of the year. And I don't know, it was some crazy number. And I don't know if I'll get the numbers exactly right, but the top so many players made 70 or 80% of their money in like half a dozen of the tournaments.
I think
half a dozen
the old cliche was that you won 90% of your money in 10% of your tournaments.
Something like that.
Yeah, it was
exactly.
Like, yeah.
So, and that's the way the system's set up, which is fine. I know my personality, I would have a hard time being the ups and downs. I would, you know, the highs obviously would be great, but those weeks where you're playing terrible, I'd have a hard time with that. I'd much rather have a Scottie Scheffler kind of year where you just play at a consistent level of, you know, maybe not brilliance and not as well as we know he's potentially
capable. But nobody's going to remember that. I don't think.
Well,
10 years from now, people are going to talk about that. I'm not sure they are.
No, I don't think they will. But that's the way the media is. That's the way everything is now. It's what have you done for me lately?
I know.
You know who's on top. You know, they don't care who's down.
Plus, I think the equipment is something to do with this as well.
I don't think.
I mean, it allows them to swing a lot harder than you.
I don't think there's any question that the equipment has brought. So when we played, to me, say the first year we had 125, which was 83, I think was the first 80. Yeah, I think it was 83 was the first year of the 125.
Thanks to going apart.
Right. But the difference between your top 3, 4, 5 players and your 125th best player was wide.
Yeah.
I mean, it was wide.
Yeah.
I mean, it was. And in fact, the first few years that we went to 125, you virtually had the same guys finish between 100 and 125 every year.
Yeah.
They were good enough for that, but they weren't.
And you can always argue that they bring nothing to the table.
Correct.
You know? Yeah.
I think the equipment, the instruction, the physical workouts that they do now has shrunk that divide.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I think the 125th best player now and Scottie Scheffler, it's a much tighter, you know.
It's especially true in driving. I don't know how you feel about that. Back in the, your kind of generation, maybe slightly after, Nick Price, Greg Norman, Ian Woosnam separated themselves to a great extent with their driving. Now, Rory doesn't get the same benefit.
If you look back, probably all the way up until probably close to the mid-90s, certainly the early 90s, all through the 80s, top 10 in driving accuracy usually was high on the money list.
Yeah.
Now, has nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
Has absolutely nothing to
do. How do you feel about that?
It's probably disappointing to a certain degree, but, you know, it's like everything changes. I mean, you know, things change. The way the game's played now has changed from the way Jack Nicklaus played the game
I hear that.
You know,
I don't think it's changed, but it's not for the better.
Well, you didn't ask me that. Nah. I just said it's changed. I would tend to agree. I don't think it's necessarily for the better for a number of reasons, you know.
I mean, I've used this line a lot, and I'll keep banging on forever that if you look at the game that nobody plays like Lee Trevino or Seve Ballesteros, how can it be better?
Well, one of the amazing things to me was, you know, back by time, you know, if your natural ball flight was high and we came to Florida, you had to figure out a way to hit it lower. Conversely, when we went to a major and the greens were rock hard and your natural ball flight was low, you had to make an adjustment to try to hit the ball higher.
Of course,
Well, now the equipment can do it for you.
Yeah.
You can make the same swing, and I can get the ball to go lower, or I can get the ball to go higher.
Yeah.
With the equipment. So.
Guys, at your talent level, that it's diminished, I think. It really is.
The versatility of the players has changed to me, for a lesser degree of. It was really fun to watch, even when you were playing with a Lee Trevino or a Jack Nicklaus.
Yeah.
I mean, they would hit shots that I would just look at and go, I've never hit a shot like that. I mean, I remember the first time I played with Jack, it was at La Costa. I had won the tournament in Tallahassee, and it was opposite the week of the Tournament of Champions. And back then, they paired by weeks of winners.
Okay.
Those were the first round pairings. So I knew a year ahead of time that I was going to be playing with Jack in the first round of Tournament of Champions at La Costa. And I had met Jack before and never played with him. Couldn't have been nicer. You know, first tee, you know, anytime you have a chance to putt out, do it before I putt out. Because if you don't, then people are going to be moving around and all that. He goes, I'll try to do everything I can, but, you know, there's only going to be so much.
Yeah.
So first hole, I think he hit first. I hit, you know, reasonably good drive for me. He was 20 yards past me.
Yeah.
Second hole, kind of the same thing. Third hole's par 3. Next hole's a long par 4. And again, he still got the honor. I think we'd all made pars. And he hits this drive, and, you know, I mean, it didn't look a whole lot different. And I hit, again, felt like the same kind of drive for me, 40 yards past me.
Yeah.
Had another gear.
Yeah.
But he only used it when he felt like it was an advantage.
Yeah.
And the rest of the time, he was satisfied with just, you know, control. The other shot he hit that day that still to this day I marvel at, there was a par 5 on the back 9. and he hit a good drive. And so I had already laid up, and I was kind of back over here behind him, you know, just watching. And he pulls out this one iron, and he makes this swing, and I almost miss seeing the ball. It got up so fast and carried like 220 yards, you know, landed like a wedge on the green, you know, about 12 feet in the hole. Really?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you do that? Yeah. I mean, with the old equipment and I mean, it was just, but he had that, you know, he had that much ability. He had the, he had, and then you got with Trevino and, you know, there was always talk, oh, Trevino can't hit a draw. Trevino could hit every shot he needed to hit.
Yeah.
I mean, and the only thing he had problems with, and I will say, is when the greens got really firm, because his ball flight tended to be a little bit lower than a lot than your
He convinced himself he couldn't play Augusta.
Right. Oh yeah, yeah. But he could. He could have if he wanted to.
I mean, I always felt a bit sorry for people, you know, from minority backgrounds. Mm-hmm. You know, they were never going to be comfortable in that place. Mm-hmm. I mean, even now you can see the remnants of the old South, and I sympathize with that. Yeah. Point of view, I must admit.
I'm sure it was very difficult.
Yeah, the best players you played with, obviously, maybe you've already told me the answer to that.
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, Jack was Jack. I mean, there's a reason why he won 18 majors and runner up in 19 of them, you know, because he was that good.
Yeah.
Watson was great, but in a very different way. You know, he played the game a little bit more like the young players play now.
Right.
I mean, drove the ball not very straight for that generation for being a great player. But his putting for the longest time was just ungodly. I mean, everybody talks about Ben Crenshaw. And great. Look, I played with Ben since we were 16 years old. And Ben is truly one of the greatest putters ever. But Tom Watson had a run there on the tour from probably, you know, 78 to, you know, certainly pretty much through the 80s, he probably made three or four putts over 20 feet every round.
Mm, yeah.
Not just once in a while, every round.
He certainly did that when he won the Open.
Right.
You know, I mean,
and that was not abnormal.
When he beat Jack at Turnberry, I mean, he stole it, really.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And that was not abnormal.
No.
I mean, that was the way he played. Johnny Miller, when Johnny was on with his iron play.
You can make the case for him maybe playing the best golf ever for that brief period.
Short period of time.
You can. He's in the conversation.
The few times that I played with him, it wasn't long after I got on tour where he started kind of losing interest and all that. But the few times that I did play with him, back in that day, it was very hard to hit the golf ball and have it go dead straight. It usually curved one way or the other. I mean, you know, most guys either figured out they were going to hit a gut most of the time or they were going to hit a draw most of the time. When he got going, he hit the ball dead straight. Mm-hmm. And his distance control with his irons was unbelievable. I mean, Andy Martinez tells the story, you know, his longtime caddy. I used to give him yardages and half yards now.
Come on.
But you start looking at great tie-in here with my old colleague, Roger Maltby. So Roger got on tour the year
Roger's done this podcast.
Oh, has he?
I love Roger.
So he got on tour the year before I did, 1975. And Roger hadn't played a lot outside of California. You know, he good junior player, good amateur player, college at San Jose State. You know, he was a good player, but hadn't had a lot of national exposure. So he makes the, you know, makes the tour, and he goes to Phoenix is the first week. He Monday qualifies. You know, he says, you know, I played pretty nicely. I'm really kind of happy with, you know, I shoot five under for the week, and you know, I'm in next week in Tucson, and I go down to Tucson, and you know, I played. You know, not too bad in Tucson. I shot like four under or something like that.
Did he celebrate, perhaps?
I'm sure he did. And then he says, I look at Johnny's scores. Johnny has shot 49 under par for those 2 weeks. And Roger says, I've played pretty well, and I'm 9 under. He's beaten me by 40 shots in those two tournaments.
Exactly.
But that was Johnny. When he got on, I mean, he really could hit his irons unlike anybody I've ever seen. Obviously, modern day, I never played with Tiger, but watched him a tremendous amount doing television. And there was the same thing. There was that period of time, late 99 to about 2005, and he just hit shots that nobody else
could. Yeah, I think that probably has to be the best golf we've ever seen.
I think so, too. Yeah. I, you know, as great as Jack was when you played with him, his short game was very average by tour standards. Yeah. But he also averaged probably 15 or 16 greens around.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like he needed to have a good short game. His bunker play was probably...
He was a good putter.
Yeah, he was a very good putter. Yeah. Bunker play was even probably below average tour average. Tiger came along. He was the only guy I've ever seen that had everything. Short game was fabulous. Great putter.
Yeah.
Hit the ball long. You know, I mean, that year that he won the U.S. Open by 15, for the year, he hit like 70% of the fairways.
Yeah.
And long. Yeah. So he was the first guy I saw that, you know, that seemed to have every aspect of his game at that level.
Yeah. Which is a seamless lead into, you know this is coming, the your comment on Tiger's putt on the 17th green at Sawgrass.
Mm-hmm.
When you did that, obviously it's spontaneous when you do it. How soon afterwards did people start saying it to you, and how, you know, down the years, how often do you hear it?
Yeah, John, obviously when it happened, it was a huge moment. I mean, don't get me that. Yeah. I've often told people it was just another Tiger moment. I mean, again, we just talked about it. He did things that nobody else did.
It was
did.
A ridiculous putt.
Oh, well, you know, the setup to it is I had seen, you know, I've been there all day watching the 17th hole from my tower. Four or five guys had been up in that same area of the green. All of them had putted the ball off the green into the fringe.
Right.
So as soon as Tiger's ball got up there, I hit Tommy Roy, our producer, on the talkback, and I said, look, Tommy, you know, four or five guys have literally, everybody up there's putted it off the green. Everybody's missed the hole to the right, hadn't read the putt right. I mean, it's just been, it's a nightmare.
Yeah.
Well, back then, we always went to commercial. As the guys walked around to 17, it was a perfect 2 minute, you know, go away for a break. So he goes, look, we come back, we'll set this up, which we did a great job of setting it up. And then he makes this putt, and it's like, oh my, I mean, literally my tower was 100 plus yards from the 17th year, and the hair on my arms was standing up. Mm-hmm. And you have to remember back then, there weren't all those corporate skyboxes on top of the hill. Mm-hmm. To the left of 17, those people were all outside on the hill and behind. And the reaction, and of course, his reaction, you know, big old fist pumps, and not only does he do it one, he turns around to the gallery and does it again, you know, to rile them up. You go back and watch it, and there's like a 40-second period where nobody says a word. Nobody.
Yeah.
Director did a great job, you know, replay of Tiger's reaction and the crowd and da-da-da-da-da. And finally, Tommy Roy says in my ear, okay, Gary, you know, you can talk now. And I said to Johnny, I think it's safe to say you could hit that putt 100 times and you'd make it once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he did, you know, but that was, but that was him.
But that phrase has become
it
almost,
have you trademarked it?
Right, you should almost do that.
Well, I tried.
Ah, there you go.
It's owned by the PGA Tour.
Ah, okay.
Because it was uttered in a PGA Tour
broadcast. Right, okay.
So, right after it happened, obviously the excitement was there. But, you know, it kind of, I wouldn't say it faded away, but it was never really a big deal.
Yeah.
And then it was probably, golly, I don't know, that was 2001. It was probably about 5 years later.
Really?
Golf Channel started using it a lot to do the promo for the players.
Right.
And that's when it really started taking on a life of its own. And, you know, I'd be out, you know, riding the course, doing my homework. Hey, better than most, you know. And occasionally, you know, especially if we're at a tournament and you're flying in or you're flying out and there's a lot of golf fans around. You're like, yeah, I hear, you know. It's funny. So I went to order some club glove luggage. And the guy, Jeff Harrell, who runs the company, says, well, do you want your initials on your bag? And I said, no, I don't like having my name on anything. I don't want people to know it's my stuff. And he goes, well, you know, some of the guys are putting different things on there. He goes, Stenson just put 261 on his because that's the score he shot at, you know, to win the Open Championship. So I said, well, let me think about it for a second. And I said, okay, put BTM on mine. And he goes, BTM. I said, yeah, better than most.
That's good. Yeah.
I kid.
You shouldn't have told the world that.
Well, I kid people that my tombstone, it'll be etched on my tombstone.
Yeah. Were you ever close to Ryder Cup?
I was relatively close in both 83 and 85. So I won a tournament. I won at Doral in 83. I had a good year. I think I had maybe five other top 10 finishes. I think it was like 13th or 14th on the list.
Yeah.
Then I had a good 84 where I won twice. And then 85 was okay. I had a couple of chances to win and I didn't. And I think I was like 15th or 16th. So I never really, you know, and back then they
disappointment.
Well, yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. You know, back then they just basically took the top 12. Yeah. I mean, there weren't any captain's picks or anything like that. Yeah, it was a disappointment, sure. You know, having represented the United States twice in the Walker Cup, once in the World Amateur Championship, it's special. You know, it's special when you get introduced on the first tee as representing your country.
What do you think about what it's become? It's different now than the time you just
mentioned. Yeah, it certainly is. To be perfectly honest with you, no offense to the Open Championship or the U.S. Open or the Players Championship, it was always my favorite broadcast of it. Because you see things in that.
Well, it brings out every aspect of human nature, doesn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Yeah. You see things in the Ryder Cup that you never see.
Yeah.
In any other golf event, you know, the camaraderie, the team aspect of it, the emotion, the, you know, it's a remarkable competition.
Well, it does things to people, and I hate to pick on Jay Haas, but I do with this anecdote. The last hole at Oak Hill in 1995, I mean, he hit this pop-up.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the poor guy could barely walk,
right.
Never mind hit a shot. Right. And we're talking about a guy who's won tournaments, experienced.
Right.
You know,
oh yeah. Well, how about Mark Hatabeki's tee shot?
Oh, I know.
17 at Kiawah Island. Yeah. I mean, that was the shot hit by a 25 handicap.
Yes. Player. Yeah.
So you know,
how do you explain that?
Right.
Well, what's different?
I guess you know, and again, having not played in a Ryder Cup, but having played in the Walker Cup, and when you're playing for more than just yourself.
Hmm.
It amplifies the pressure just that much more. You know, you don't want to let your teammates down.
Yeah.
You just, and especially those, I mean, how Bernhard Langer missed that putt at Kiawah and then turned around and won the very next week in Germany on the European Tour.
Yeah.
Mind boggling to me, but not knowing Bernhard, but still, you just don't want to let your teammates down. Yeah. And that adds a layer of pressure.
I mean, I think it's the greatest thing to watch when it's close.
Yes,
it has to be close because we haven't had a close one since Medina, unfortunately. Right. But there are aspects of it that I find pretty distasteful. The crowd aspect of it.
I think it's not something we
want to encourage.
I think that's the problem. I think it has been encouraged to go beyond. Mm. I mean, it's one thing to support your team.
No problem.
It's another thing to have fun on that first tee with songs and this and that and the other. But certainly some of the level of animosity toward the other team by fans has gotten out of control at times.
Yeah, it's disappointing, but my goodness, it's a great event.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, it's fun to be a part of.
Yeah, and I, you know,
although I will tell people, and I've had friends, I've gotten tickets for friends, and I tell them ahead of time, it is the worst personal viewing experience ever because you can't see anything.
Well, I tell people that too. Watch on TV.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I say, look, if it's a bucket list item and you want to go just to say you've been to a Ryder Cup, fine.
Yeah.
But if you actually want to watch the golf, you've got no chance.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
how do you handle things like that? Not just in the Ryder Cup, but just generally when somebody hits a really bad shot out, you know, in broadcasting, is there something holding you back?
Well, no, I think through the years, look, there's no reason we shouldn't say that it's a bad shot or that sometimes it's a horrible shot.
Yeah.
The player knows that.
Yeah.
You know, some announcers, one I used to work with, had a tendency at times to kind of make the person out to be a bad person. Because they hit a bad shot or made a bad decision.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's, you don't need that.
Yeah.
You know, the other is every now and then, and look, there are some guys that get away with stuff, you know, that others don't. sometimes the attempt at humor can backfire as well.
Yeah.
And
well, in a politically correct world, humor is the first thing out the window.
Yeah. Nowadays, yes. I mean, I you know, and look, I you know David Faraday very well. I enjoyed working with David. You know, one of the reasons David told me that he left NBC to go to Lib because he said, I can be me.
Yeah.
I can actually say the stupid things that pop into my brain and keep my job.
Right.
You know, said I couldn't do that at NBC.
No. Last question or the last area we're going to get into. I'm conscious that I've kept you here quite a while, but the Lib Golf thing and the way things are right now. I mean, I ask everybody this question, obviously, because it's the obvious question to ask, but where are we? Where do you think we're going? And where would you like it to go?
Well, where are we? I probably have about the same knowledge that everybody else does. I mean, I was with Commissioner Monahan just last week at the Payne Stewart Award, and we talked very briefly about it, not any great detail.
Yeah.
He did say that negotiations are ongoing and being held on a regular basis, and I think it sounded like from him that the tour has an idea of what this should be and Liv has an idea of what this should be, this new entity that's being created for profit.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that'll ever come together, who knows?
Yeah.
What would I like to see? For sure, I would like to see the PGA Tour remain the 501c3 that it is, not for profit, to where the legacy of the tour of benefiting others. I mean, literally, you think about it, John, and I said it in my speech the other night at the Payne Stewart Award, no other professional sport leaves each town that it visits better off than when it got there. And the PGA Tour does that every single week.
Yeah.
So I would pray that that does not change.
Yeah.
That's a legacy to me that just is hugely important. And to lose that and to think of all the guys before now who have been a part of that and helped create the billions that the tour has done, but and all the money that the individuals raise for good works in their own communities. So I would pray that that stays the same.
Mm-hmm.
Is that possible? I don't. I have no idea.
People who are not American like me have been banging on for years that there should be more recognition of, you know, from the PGA Tour about the rest of the world. And I mean, they've been kind of bullies in terms of bigger tours have always bullied the smaller tours. I see this time as an opportunity, a potential opportunity to create something that would be much more global in nature. I mean, Australia gets, you know, it's basically screwed. I mean, there's some wonderful courses there.
Oh, sure.
Wonderful weather, some great players, all the rest of it. It's crying out for a 3-week visit from the best players in the world, just as an example. Is that something that you would like to see, or is that a pipe dream? Is the PGA Tour never going to do that? Other players, because of the money they earn, they're never going to do that?
The tough part about that is, and again, you've got such a diverse group of the 200 members of the PGA Tour. You know, I can promise you there are a lot of guys that would just as soon play their 25 tournaments in the United States.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Make a nice living and go home.
Yeah.
How many of them would look forward to going to Australia for a 3-week swing? Maybe some of your top players, if you guarantee them, you know, the money to go, which unfortunately seems to be coming more and more the norm these days, whether it's outright just guarantees or whether it's PIP programs or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I see your point. I do. And I think it would be great for the game. I just don't know if you would get the cooperation from the players you would need to have it be successful.
I get that. And realistically, there's too many agendas at play.
Yes.
For everybody went into the room and let's do what's best for golf, that's what would happen. But that's, I agree. You know, it's not.
I'm afraid you're right about that.
You touched on the Payne Stewart Award. We should mention that. You were honored just last week. I saw that. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Must have been nice.
Big surprise. I had no idea he'd even been nominated. Mm-hmm. PGA Tour pulled a great one on me. So I got a call about 6 weeks before I found out that PGA Tour Productions would like to come to my house. They're getting ready to start work on the 50-year anniversary video of the players. Next year, right. 2024, is the 50th anniversary. Yeah. You've played in a number of them. You've called the 17th hole for the last 25 years, got some great stories, memories, da-da-da. Sound legitimate, right?
Yeah.
So the crew shows up. Lights are all set up in my living room. Makeup on, the whole bit. Ladies asking me all these questions about 17. Da-da-da-da, players. All of a sudden, my front door opened, and Tracy Stewart walks in holding the Peyton Stewart trophy.
Hopefully.
And as I said in my talk the other night, thank goodness I didn't say the first thing that popped into my mind, which was holy.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, imagine. I mean, just totally taken off guard. I mean, it just, but I also said, you know, to be thought of in the same vein as Peyton Stewart, especially for what the award stands for. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just how you've played the game. It's kind of how you've conducted yourself and been a part of the game, you know, for a long period of time.
You find, and this is not particular to you, when you played as long as you did, and you did as well as you did, mm-hmm. and you go into broadcasting, people forget that you were a player. Peter Ralles was a perfect example. I mean, and there's many others.
Oh.
I mean, how do you feel about that?
I had guys.
You feel like saying, come on, I was a player.
When you kind of make it a point, when these new young guys get out on tour, I mean, you need to meet them, you know, because you're going to be talking about them and you want to.
Never heard of you.
Trying to develop some sort of relationship with them and, you know, to where when they play well and you would like to talk to them, it's not like you're meeting them or talking to them for the first time.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you how many times these young guys, you know, our first event was off in the Honda, you know, so a lot of times the Honda field wasn't great. So a lot of the guys from the Q school got in. So I'm on the range on Tuesday afternoon. I'm interviewed. And I mean, some of these guys would look at me like, who are you?
Well, I'm meeting guys now who've never heard of Sebi.
Right.
I mean, you think.
I mean, yeah.
You know,
yeah. So a quick story. Guy who actually played on a Ryder Cup team for the U.S. Mm-hmm. Playing in the pro member at Seminole. Several years back. This was several years back. So I'm playing with Vinny Giles, my longtime agent, British amateur champion, U.S. amateur champion, senior U.S. amateur champion, right?
Before you go any further, I'm going to bring this. I was going to mention this earlier, but you played in this 1973 U.S. Open and lost by 12 shots to your manager.
I did.
Not many people have done that.
Correct. But he's really good.
Oh, I know.
He was really good back then.
Yeah.
And that was my first venture into a major.
Yeah. Anyway, I interrupted.
Yeah. So we're playing with this gentleman and the other member. And look, I've talked to this guy before on the range, and, you know, he's a good player. Hadn't won a tournament, but, yeah, he was a good player. So about the third hole, he kind of wanders over to me, and he says, your partner's pretty good. You know, like, what's he done? And I said, well, he's won the U.S. amateur. He's won the British amateur. He's won the senior amateur.
Yeah.
You know, he's a club champion here.
Low Am in the Masters.
You know, Low Am in the Masters. Low Am in the U.S. Open.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So about four or five holes later, he comes back over to me. He says, you played on tour, didn't you? I said, yeah, as a matter of fact, I did for about 15 years. He says, you ever win a tournament? I said, well, yeah, I won six. He goes, oh, and walks off.
Yeah. I mean, that always perplexes me. I'm a bit of a geek when it comes to that.
Well, John, let me tell you, here's what I did. In 1975, when I got through the qualifying school, we had a rookie orientation that we had to go to. So one of the things I requested at that orientation from the media person that was kind of dealing with this, please send me a media guide. And I went through that media guide, and I knew all the players. And I knew a little something about all the players. Because, look, when you first start, you know you're going to get paired with the other guys who are just starting.
Yeah.
But then when you make the cut, it's random. You never know who you're going to end up paired with.
That was the journalist and you did that.
I was. And, you know, I wanted to know a little something about these guys. Yeah. I mean, if I was meeting Jerry McGee for the first time, I'd like to know he was from Palestine, Ohio, and, you know, had played college golf here. And, you know, just to be able to say something to him. And so, but these guys now are just – Vladimir Klitsch.
Yeah, I know. It's I'm looking at my little list of questions here.
Sure.
And I think we've touched just about everything.
Okay.
But Gary, thank you for your time. You've been very generous, especially as you've come straight from the golf course to do this.
Well, no problem at all, John. Happy to do it, and keep up the great work.
Okay, thank you again.
Okay.
Cheers.
Some terrific insights there into both golf and television from one of the more low-key but best in the business. Thanks again to Gary for taking part. And that's it for episode 105, but make sure to come back next time when we do it all again on The Thing About Golf.